If you want to. I'll do that.
All right, good morning, everyone. Called order the meeting of the House Transportation Economic Development Committee. It is Groundhog Day, February 2nd, 2012. We have two bills up today, which are both focused on infrastructure, developing Oregon infrastructure. So I'll open a public hearing on both House Bill 4020 and House Bill 4028. Invite Representative Schaffler to come forward, and Patrick, give us a quick run through.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4020 authorizes an additional $10 million in lottery bonds to finance grants and loans for transportation projects under the Connect Oregon 4 program from 2011. That bill is also copied in House Bill 4028. Section 1 of 4028 does the same thing and also authorizes $10 million in lottery bonds to finance water and sewer infrastructure projects, $10 million to finance community college capital construction, and $20 million to be issued to the Oregon Growth Account. Both measures have emergency clauses and would take effect upon passage. Both have subsequent referrals to joint ways and means, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Schaffler, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for letting me in early. I'm State Representative Mike Schaffler, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland. I support both these bills. Mr. Chair, I like yours better because there's more in it. And as Patrick so well spelled out, there's other people behind me that will fill in some more details. So I hope we pass 4028. And I want to remind all of you, we need a lot of gravel to do these projects, and I need you to help me get it. And while I'm here, Mr. Chair, and I'm almost done, I don't think we should pass any health care or education reform bills until a good water bill and a good timber bill pass this, and the governor sign those bills out of this building, because we can, half a billion dollars for 5 years will run out. What are we going to do then? We won't have any money. That money is not sustainable, doesn't create any private sector jobs. Water and timber do, and gravel, and we need to build a strong, workable infrastructure to help these businesses, and these two bills help do that, Mr. Chair. Unless there's any questions, I will get out of here and leave you alone and quit causing so much trouble.
This is dangerous. Well, Representative Widener is asking you a question.
Good.
Go ahead.
Well, Representative Schaffler just kind of spurred this question. So you're saying you don't like the large expansion of government that we're proposing in some of the governor's stuff, and we want to put people back to work?
No, that's not what I said, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't have the answer, other people will be testifying might be able to answer it. Has anybody identified offsets for this? And because I understand that we're right at the cusp of our debt load.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't specifically answer that question. I do understand the Treasurer has examined both these bills and he's comfortable with them, but I'll let an expert answer that question.
Yeah, and I see we're going to have folks from the Treasurer's office up next, so we're going to you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Shopper, appreciate it. Yeah, so let's go ahead and invite maybe both Mike and Laura to come up from the Treasurer's office. I think this is one of those rare bills as we look at lots of general fund related bills this session within the Ways and Means process. We do have it's a separate pot of money, both because it's lottery versus general fund, but also because it's bonding versus spending on dollars today. But hopefully our witnesses here can speak to that and speak to Representative Lindsay's question. Welcome.
Welcome. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division in the State Treasurer's Office, and I am also the staff to the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, whose report should be in your inbox.
Right.
It's this right here. Unfortunately, the state printer was one of the floods, so it took a little longer to get you your copies than we had hoped. We met earlier in the month of January and reviewed the debt capacity forecasts for both lottery bonds and general fund debt. Today's hearing on lottery, I have just a few remarks, if that's all right. What we've noticed is a six-year forecast is what we use of lottery revenues, not just the current biennium, to forecast what's existing debt, what's been authorized by the legislature, how quickly we'll pay off the debt we have. What we've noticed is that the six-year forecast of lottery revenue has dropped. First, it dropped by just under 9% between 09 and 10, and it dropped another 3%. This is in December of each year that we look in the most recent forecast. and that has shrunk our lottery capacity. The good news is interest rates are also a little lower, so that's helped balance out some of the loss of capacity. So we forecast that we will be right at the 4x coverage, which is about 25% of revenues, which is the forecast is both in the bond indenture as well as the policy of the committee for this fiscal year. There is a small amount of capacity available based on current forecasts, current interest rates, et cetera, for next fiscal year. And that's roughly in about $50 million. But that puts us right at the edge. There is no cushion. So the commission was a bit nervous about just saying, oh, just go do it. And the caveats I need to give you are if lottery revenues continue to forecast continue to drop and or if interest rates move up, then that $50 million could be squeezed. And really what I wanted to let you know is that as we do every year, we'll do another forecast in January of 2013 prior to the legislative session starting. So if things are approved this year, which is fine, just know that we'll come back next year and give you an update right before we would really sell the bonds for whatever you might approve either last year or this year as well. I have open for questions.
Actually, Mike, did you have anything to add to that? Go ahead, Representative Lizzie.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, I just want everybody to know I'm totally for infrastructure. I think it's one of those higher priorities than other things. At the same time, though, and I understand debt capacity. I can take on debt capacity, more debt capacity in my home as well. But before I do that, I'm going to be paying off some other things. And I'm going to be driving my car a little bit longer as well. And so I guess my question is can we identify some other things that we can pay down quickly before we increase this capacity? I understand that we have capacity, but can we identify and get rid of some things, higher interest, other things, before we take on this?
Through the chair, Representative Lindsay, we will be selling a small amount of new money lottery bonds later this spring in April. We are also looking at refunding some existing lottery bonds to the extent that interest rates have dropped and stay lower. We will be able to reduce some of our debt service costs. But as far as paying off lottery bonds that we have outstanding, that would require you to appropriate some lottery revenue dollars so we could call those bonds. So in a tight budget situation, perhaps it might be challenging, but I will assure you that we're doing, between lottery bonds and general obligation bonds, $850 million of refundings between now and May. So we are actively taking advantage of what's, as of last week, was the lowest interest rates in the municipal bond market since the 60s.
Co-Chair Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very much appreciate your insight into this challenging issue. Can you give us a historical perspective of how this legislature has addressed this limit in the past? Do we always borrow right up to the exact amount that we have available for borrowing, or is there generally a cushion?
Through the chair, Representative Vents, I've worked here since 2004, and we used to chart where our coverage ratios were. And our coverage ratios were much higher than the 4x coverage. In essence, the percentage of lottery revenues that needed to be used for debt service was a lot lower. It wasn't up to the 25%. I'm not sure before I arrived, 2003, but I can tell you that revenues were growing faster than our ability to spend it, because when we introduced line games, there was a huge jump up in lottery revenues. Again, not just one-year forecast, but a longer-term revenue forecast. And so I did see it start dropping probably in 2009, that we were getting a little closer to our coverage. What's happened this time was I think we didn't do all that was theoretically available, which was 282, we thought about a year ago. We went to 222. What's happened is revenues have continued to drop, so there is a little bit of a cushion, mostly just because interest rates in my forecast are a little lower. So we're getting closer to that little edge than we probably have been historically.
Follow up? When you mentioned interest rates, can you share with us the impact that a rising interest rate environment would have upon our borrowing? In other words, if interest rates were to suddenly go up, what's that?
Sure, and that's the big caveat. We can't really know with a crystal ball what long-term interest rates are, but what we look at is a five-year historical trend. And so in this report, we've used a 5% long-term rate. If I were to borrow today, it would probably be 4%. So I've already built a little cushion of protection. But we do, if interest rates go up higher than our forecast, so we're using a 5% number, it would reduce debt capacity per biennium. Now, this is out biennium. It's not the current one we're in, but just on average by about $40 million. So if you got a full 1%, I can't envision that, but who knows? Right now, we're in these very, very low interest rate environments, and we didn't want to go all the way down to the bottom in our forecasting. So, you know, I'm a fairly conservative person because I want to always deliver whatever the legislature authorizes. I think we have a little bit of cushion, but a year from now, the situation could be different. That's why my recommendation is if you approve things, have us come back and update that forecast for you. The good news is if we can get through this hump, because we have a debt service kind of a peak that we're trying to shave off, we get out to the two next bienniums, we have $300 million plus of capacity because debt gets paid off fairly rapidly. So I think we're just, this next year will be our last really tight, challenging year, and there should be a lot more capacity and a lot better choices from a public policy perspective for legislators to make.
Please. Thank you. The refinancing that you're doing right now that you just mentioned, is that the opportunity for that? Are we taking full advantage of that opportunity, or are there constraints that are preventing us from doing so?
Well, we have to live under federal tax law. And under federal tax law, you're only allowed one advanced refunding on a bond issue. And so to the extent that you have to choose, okay, is this the right moment to do that advance refunding or should I wait a few years? The closer you get to a call date, the more optimal your overall situation. The problem is when you do an advance refunding, you put the refunding proceeds into an escrow. Well, that is in Treasury securities, which are offering you very, very low interest rates. So it's called negative arbitrage. So you have to weigh the refunding opportunity of what you can save versus the drag that this negative arbitrage causes. We try and do an efficiency analysis, and if we can save more money on debt service and it's costing us in the escrow, then we proceed. And we just go through that analysis on each state bond issue and try and optimize the timing of when we refund even. So it may look really good, but there's other factors involved in a refunding.
Right. Thank you very much.
Representative Weider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some bills we have up in other committees. So, and I'm not sure if you've looked at them, but dealing with problem gambling.
Through the chair, yes. I haven't read the bill, but I noticed that was there.
There could be some revenue impacts on that. And I'm
certainly
just wondering if this is being taken into consideration, because if we're this close to our debt limit and some of those bills have very good traction, that's going to decrease revenues coming in from lotteries. So I'm just wondering if we've analyzed those, take those into consideration as well, because I can see that affecting things and some of the things that we're discussing in some of the other committees, to where is that going to put us upside down in some of these, if we go forward with some of this other legislation? Because it looks like we're running right against the cushion, and now we pass one of these pieces of legislation, we're upside down all of a sudden.
Through the chair, I'm not the revenue forecaster, and I know there is a number of factors that go into overall lottery revenue streams, and that's just the nature of that particular revenue stream that I can't really else comment on. But
I guess, if I may, would it concern you if one of those bills passed and we went ahead and approved these bond measures?
Well, through the chair, obviously there's lots of factors, which is why our job is to implement whatever the legislature authorizes and then to provide you insight into the implications. Again, it would all depend, I think, on how much the gambling, you know, that other bill really cut into long-term revenues. It's not a 1 or 2 year forecast. We look at 6 years. Some of the longer term trends that I'm aware of when I do lottery bond rating presentations with the folks at lottery have to do with the changing age and demographics of who plays the lottery, the smoking ban, casinos inside or outside of our state. So there's so many different factors that it would be hard for me to tell you with any kind of sort of authority as to which factor is the most important factor in that forecast. But I suspect people in legislative revenue and OEA could give you a lot more insight in terms of, you know, what are the real drivers of what generates or ruins lottery revenues. So, to some extent, it may just be the overall economy. in other downturns in the economy, I've been told that lottery revenues kept going up. But this time it's different.
Chair Benz.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I should have asked this when you mentioned it, but you said there was a space of time between now and then when we might have as much as $300 million available for this. For, what was that time?
Our debt capacity forecast looks not only at the current biennium and where we are, but also two more bienniums. So for the 13-15 and the 15-17 biennium, this report shows that we will have in excess of $600 million of future lottery capacity as old debt gets paid off and revenues continue to increase. So that's so we sort of take it about 50% per biennium. We say, well, that's about $300 per future bienniums.
Thank you.
Laura, can you speak to when I read through the debt policy advisory committee report, which is really scintillating reading.
But thank you.
The one money line that seemed to jump out at me, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think it basically said in layman's terms, be very cautious or don't do debt unless they're for, I think the phrase was critical
correct.
Economic development projects and priorities. Can you maybe speak to the
sure.
committee's separation of those kinds of things versus everything else?
Thank you. Through Representative Hunt and the group, yes, because the committee and the commission was mindful of the need to continue to do infrastructure. We're very supportive of another part of our report talks about all the various unmet capital needs the state has. We just needed to give that warning of caution that lottery revenues have been dropping, and we didn't want to say blanket prohibition. What we really wanted to say was make sure it's for the very highest priorities, and of course we'll come back a year from now and give you an update as to whether the forecasts have changed based on these outside forces. So I don't think we were saying don't do it, but what we were trying to do was to focus on the highest priority if indeed the legislature felt that they were absolutely critical to the economic well-being of the state.
And maybe one question for Mike. As you look at, not so much from the debt policy analysis angle, but from the treasurer's perspective, looking at the types of projects in this bill, can you maybe give us the treasurer's assessment of how those line up against that critical economic development projects and priorities standard?
Certainly. For the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer and Chair Hunt, members of the committee. I think historically the treasurer has tried to mostly stay out of picking and choosing particular bonding projects. However, he's very keen on ensuring that the legislature has the discretion to select projects that they feel need to be prioritized, as he feels that this is your purvey. I think that the treasurer is, or I can say for certain that the treasurer is comfortable with the provisions of this bill, given the message of caution that Laura has aptly brought into the room. But in terms of specific projects, the treasurer is going to defer to the legislature on what is critical, and we'll respect that decision.
Okay, great. Thank you both very much. Appreciate you being here. Welcome, Representative Nathanson. Nice to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We've got a bunch of folks lined up to testify. So I think we're going to ask people. Fortunately, we've got the whole committee to deal with this topic until 10. I think as I'm looking at the list, I think there is only one person who is really lined up to speak to kind of the entire bill, and then everybody else is speaking to one or two segments of it. So I'm going to call up John Mollis from the Building Trades, because I think as I'm looking down the list, you're probably the only person who will speak to the entire bill, and then we'll start getting into specific pieces. So welcome.
Well, good morning, Chair Hunt, Chair Vance, members of the committee. My name is John Mollis. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council, and our council supports both of these bills. If this committee and the legislature could see their way to pass the bill that provides for, we're obviously in favor of the extent or the additional funding for Connect Oregon projects. Those have proved very successful in the past, and we'd like to see that expanded. If you folks can see your way to passing the bigger bill that provides money for community colleges and other infrastructure projects, we're very much in support of that bill as well. As you all well know, the construction industry has suffered greatly over the last 3 years. It's a pretty safe statement to say that at any point in time, you could take the unemployment rate or underemployment rate in this state and take it times three, and that's what the construction industry has been at. So if the unemployment rate has been 8, we've been at 24. If the underemployment rate has been at 20, we've been at 60. And we're slowly starting to get better, but we still have a lot of folks out of work, and these projects would be vitally important to putting them back to work, keeping them in their homes. So I can't overstate the importance of these types of projects. And they not only benefit our members, but they put local architecture firms, local engineering firms, material suppliers, and all those folks obviously spend their dollars, and the money just continues to flow throughout the economy. And obviously they're paying taxes when they're back at work as well. So with that, I'll close, and if there's any questions, I'll do my very best to answer them.
Great. Questions for John? You answered them all. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
So I think we'll kind of try to go topically through the bill. And so we've got several folks who have signed up to testify on the Connect Oregon portion. Let's begin with a panel of Lana Butterfield, Marty Anderson, and Martin Callery. Okay. Transportation Economic Development Committee. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Rail Users League, or OREL, as we're called. First of all, I want to place on the record the written testimony of Joe Westby of Ferrellgas Propane. He couldn't be here today. And although he doesn't have a project with Connect Oregon, he has been supportive throughout the years of this program. Paul Langner of Teven Brothers in Rainier is the new OREL president, and he couldn't be here today, but he has testified before you on several occasions, and I wanted to bring forward his testimony from your November hearing because I want to talk to you just briefly about it later. On behalf of the Oregon Rail Users League, we strongly encourage this committee to send both House Bill 4020 and 4028 to the Ways and Means Committee. We believe that Connect Oregon has been extremely beneficial to the economy of Oregon. It creates family wage jobs. It improves Oregon's multimodal transportation system. It improves travel for transit and passenger rail. It gets Oregon products to market. It is rebuilding our industrial base. It has a multiplier effect of strengthening local economies and resulting in community benefits that might not otherwise be there. It produces a cleaner environment by getting trucks off our highway. You're going to be hearing today from a number of OREL members. We have tried to bring you a little bit different perspective this time, and some people who haven't testified before. Therefore, you get to hear some new stories. I want to not continue with the written testimony, but I would like to tell you about an experience I had about 6 months ago that transformed my perception of the value of Connect Oregon from an intellectual level to something that's felt right here. And it's an experience that you could have too. When Mr. Langner became president 6 months ago, I didn't know him, or I didn't understand what Teven Brothers did or how they'd use their Connect Oregon dollars. So I asked him for a tour. And by the time that hour was up, I was extremely impressed by what I had seen, to the point that I can't stop talking about it even 6 months later. And so we would invite you to also take that tour. If you see some of those pictures, what you see is a lot of Oregon products sitting in a marine terminal yard that are being shipped to other markets. And if you go there, you get to watch all of the people at work, and you look at their faces, and they are really happy to have jobs. That has been a very smart use of Connect Oregon. It is spinning off new ventures, and it is strengthening communities, both in Rainier and in the forest products areas where their products are coming from. He makes his facility open on weekdays, weekends, during the session, during the interim, for individuals or groups, so just ask me and I'll be happy to arrange it. We had one of the co-speakers up to take this tour on a snowy day in January, and I won't tell you which one it is, except to say that this big grin crossed his face when Paul pointed to a pile of logs and said, "Those logs are from Roseburg." And in fact, there's a story about his visit posted on his Facebook page. On behalf of all O-Rule members, we ask you two things. Please pass both bills to the Ways and Means Committee. And then we want to say, number two, thank you, thank you. You are the policy committee that has made the bright spots in Oregon through the Connect Oregon program possible. And we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marty Anderson, and I'm the Oregon Operations Manager for T.Y. Lynn International, which is a consulting firm here. There's an office here in Salem and one in Beaverton. I retired from ODOT in August of this year, and in my role there, one of the roles I had at ODOT was managing and implementing the Connect Oregon program and watching the projects. And so I wanted to share with you today some of the things that I saw personally on the ground with the people that were spending this money and doing these projects. Mount Hood Railroad, for example, it would essentially have closed without Connect Oregon money. It had been washed out. And I don't want to, Jim's here to talk about that. Jim Guthrie, we'll talk about it later. But that was a tremendous success in terms of a project. The Central Oregon, they repurposed a building in downtown Bend to provide a central place for all of the transit entities to come into Bend. So people could come in from Prineville to go to the doctor. They didn't have to try to figure out how they were going to get to where they were going. Once they got to Bend, they could go to this one place and get to where they need to go on the transit system in Bend. So that was a big benefit, very big benefit to the community. The Connect Oregon 1 project in Grant County was, I don't know how many people know, but the rappel schools, the people that jump out of helicopters into fires, the school is in John Day at the Grant County Airport. The Forest Service at the time of Connect Oregon 1 was closing many of the schools around the country, and they were trying to decide which three schools they were going to keep open. John Day was not on the list because the runway was not long enough. The Connect Oregon money extended the runway. They could have, the reason it wasn't long enough because they wanted to put twin-engine tanker planes with those jump schools instead of single-engine tanker planes. It kept the school in John Day. And since then, Connect Oregon 2 funded a terminal. Forest Service rebuilt their jump school, a whole new building. It's together in a partnership with the Forest Service and Grant County and building that new terminal. Well, it's a tremendous project. It's really a very nice facility. And it brings about $5 million. The Forest Service Jump School brings about $5 million approximately to the community every year with all the people flying in to get trained to do this. Newport International Port, they got the $1.2 million in Connect Oregon. And with that seed money, they were successful in passing a bond measure for $16 million. And we went and repurposed that project to because they had that money, we went and repurposed that project and actually built it in a more logical, sequential process. And so they are in the process of rebuilding their commercial port and rebuilding some of the buildings to replace engines and boats and things like that. City 11 and Reload Facility, that project came in, there was going to be one user. They were taking a reload facility, which is moving product from their trucks to trains and back and forth. They were going to move it to a location. Once that project came up and they were going to remove it to this new location, another company came into Lebanon and said, hey, if you repurpose this and redesign this, we really like to be there too. So it brought, that project brought another company into Lebanon to use that facility. The Port of Morrow Industrial Park was, the initial Connect Oregon project was to build a 55,000 square foot warehouse. They started that project. Since that time, and they never had a reload facility at the Port of Morrow before, since that time, they've built an additional 250,000 square feet of reload facility and added an additional 50 jobs. And so you're talking about from 2007 to today, they've added 50 jobs at the Port of Morrow, and this Connect Oregon started that, seeded that. The Rogue Valley Airport, they built a transit center at the airport. So you can ride, now you can get transit, make all your switches at the airport. You don't have to rent a car every time. You have transit facilities at the airport. The other thing that they did as part of that Connect Oregon project, the Rogue Valley Airport, is provided a, they were loading and unloading the UPS trucks in the rain and the snow out on the tarmac. And now they have a facility to actually load the planes inside. And they lease, the airport makes money leasing that to the facilities, and it's cost effective for the UPS and FedEx and a number of people to provide that. And then the other thing they did at the Rogue Valley Airport is built Mercy Flight, new hangars, better facilities for Mercy Flights. And coming from Southern Oregon and having friends who had to rely on Mercy Flight, you know, to live or to get to emergency medical services. When you live in Brookings, there's not a lot there, so you're going to have to fly somewhere if you need, if you have anything that's major medical. So, you know, it just went a long ways. I got to see a lot. I have a lot more stories, but I don't have a lot of that much time. So I really support both these bills. It helps the company I'm with today because we do that design work. And it helps the industries. So support both of these bills. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mark.
Good morning, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, member of the committee. I'm Martin Callery. I'm Chief Commercial Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. We own the Coos Bay Rail Line. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4020 and 4028, both of which would increase funding for the current Connect Oregon 4 program, which is just now entering its evaluation phase with the various modal committees and with the area commissions on transportation. You have my written testimony, and I'm going to deviate somewhat from that. The Port of Coos Bay does not have an application in for Connect Oregon 4. We've been benefited from Connect Oregon 1 and 3, and in fact, funding from Connect Oregon 3 helped us reopen the Coos Bay Rail Line in October of 2011. And related to what Lana was talking about, at Teven Brothers, our Coos Bay Rail Line operator, Coos Bay Rail Link, just got a waiver from the Union Pacific Railroad to move treated wood products from a producer in Coos County up on the Portland and Western to that Teven facility for transport to Hawaii and South Sea Islands. Those wood products that go to those islands have to be treated so they're not just digested by the termites and everything else. So this is a commodity that probably would not have moved to that facility if they had to depend on trucking. Trucking rates in our area are higher because there's very few opportunities for a transload or you have to run deadhead in there to take a load out. So you're going to pay for it both ways. That's just one instance of what we've seen. And related to my service on some other committees, I serve on the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. I'm on the Lane Act and the Southwest Act. I've had the opportunity to be on several of review committees for the Connect Oregon program, specifically freight and marine modal. And we've seen a lot of good projects come forward during those processes, and realizing that this is a year that we have a lesser budget to work with. I know, just going through the project list that I've seen so far, there's a lot of good projects there. In fact, I think the project total is somewhere between $84 and $87 million. If we can fund $10 million more in projects, they're going to benefit communities, they're going to benefit Oregon's transportation system, which supports our traded sector economy, both in the U.S. and internationally. And it just builds a stronger system for our state to remain competitive in the marketplace. I urge you to support those two bills, 4020 and 4028. We believe they create jobs. We've seen the job creation in our area, and these are not just construction jobs. These are long-term jobs. That facility that's producing the treated wood products is likely to add a couple more employees as they ramp up their sales efforts. So thank you for the opportunity, and I hope you will support these bills and pass them on.
Great. Questions for any of these three witnesses? Go, Chair Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious why we're hauling logs from one port up to another one.
They're not logs.
Sorry, treated lumber. Why aren't we taking the lumber?
Well, because right now the Teven Brothers facility has become a load-centering port for shipments going to Hawaii. We also have shipments going out of Coos Bay to Hawaii, but it's an aggregation point for a variety of commodities going there, and from a transportation standpoint, it makes more sense to get all of them on bigger barges. We don't have as many barges going out of Coos Bay. In fact, we've seen a decline in barge traffic, possibly because of Teven Brothers, but that's competition. Nothing wrong with that. But the wood products manufactured in our area, much of them go by barge or have gone by barge in the past, mostly to the Southern California region. But the treated wood products, since there's a growing demand for that in the South Pacific region, and Teven has captured, in fact, Sauce Brothers Ocean Towing, which is headquartered in Coos Bay, Sauce Brothers Ocean Towing is working through the Teven facility on the Columbia River, and they're still operating out of Coos Bay also. So it's simply the economics of the transportation system at work in this particular case.
Yeah. Follow up. Yes. Right. So the real point is, you just need a workable facility between the two ports, because then we can go either direction. Competition works better that way. So
well, in the chairs, Representative Ben or Co-Chair Benz, in the case of the Teven facility. They did a lot to build up a facility that was aggregating cargo up and down the river and from the region. Our ability to put the Coos Bay rail line back in service back in October allowed this company that produces treated wood products in the Coos Bay area to ship by rail, which was more economically viable than shipping by truck. What we have to do, because we're captive to the Union Pacific Railroad on the Coos Bay Rail Line, that's our interchange point to the national rail system, UP doesn't really want that business. It's short-haul business, but it can go to the Portland and Western. But by having the Coos Bay Rail Line open, we have the ability to move that cargo at a cheaper cost, at a lower cost, up to this facility. If we didn't have the Coos Bay Rail Line back in service by now, it probably wouldn't be moving.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Appreciate all three of you being here. Thanks so much. Next up, Toby and Altverst, Skip Tarr, and Ralph Saperstein, please. Please proceed. Whichever order you'd like.
Okay. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Toby Van Altworst. I'm general manager of the City of Prineville Railway in Prineville, Oregon. and I'm here this morning to speak in strong support of House Bill 4020 and 4028. And the City of Prineville Railway is unique in that it was built in 1918 by the City of Prineville so that they would be connected to the National Rail Network. And it's been owned and operated by the city ever since. It's been, for many years, an economic development driving force in the region. And after World War II, the region saw a boom in timber products manufacturing, primary sawmills. At one time, Prineville really was a timber town with five sawmills. And through the 80s and the 90s, that's dwindled to nothing. And so Prineville's had to continually reinvent itself. And while it still has a strong secondary forest products manufacturing industry, it does not have that primary industry any longer. The railroad at that time saw a significant decline in carloads from over 10,000 a year down to, in 2001, just 87 carloads. And the community recognized that that transportation infrastructure, it was still vital to economic development opportunities for the future of Prineville. And so instead of giving up on that, the city found a way to work to improve the infrastructure, cut its costs, and start growing that business again. And with the help of Connect Oregon 1, 2, and 3, we've managed to build a very well-designed and constructed transload facility that allows us to have freight move between rail and truck very easily in the region, both inbound and outbound. And in speaking to a few opportunities that we've seen, we have a significant amount of traffic that moves into the area, into Prineville by truck from the region to be loaded on rail cars to go to distant markets. I guess in speaking a little bit more to the other part of 24 or 4028, the OSU Cascades campus distance learning office has just been recently built over there. We actually brought a carload of brick in from North Dakota that was used in construction of that building that came in by rail and was delivered through our Prineville Freight Depot to the construction site. So there's a lot of commerce moving both directions there. Our biggest lumber shipper today is located in John Day. It's Malheur Lumber. They ship product by truck to Prineville to be loaded on rail cars to go to markets in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, New York, and South and the Carolinas, as well as more recently we just had a shipment go to Mexico. And so where this becomes this infrastructure that is so vital to the transportation connectivity for this industry in particular is that by allowing them access to rail economically, they can get to distant markets they couldn't otherwise afford to sell into by truck. The truck transportation would be too expensive for them to sell their product there. Most of those distant markets, their competition is Southern Yellow Pine, and obviously has a significant transportation advantage to the East Coast because that's where it grows. So anyway, the success story that we can tell is that through this project, we've been able to connect businesses like Malheur Lumber to distant markets, and it brings money from those distant places, and including even in international trade, to Prineville, to John Day, where it supports jobs, and of course, the guys that work at the mill in John Day go spend money in service industry at the grocery store in John Day, support additional jobs, and that's what the state needs now is jobs. It needs jobs for the welfare of the people, and it needs jobs to generate tax revenue for supporting additional transportation infrastructure investments and other investments that we need to make in our state. So anyway, I appreciate your time this morning. I just want to say that, like Prineville is, we don't have a Connect Oregon 4 project this time, just like Martin was saying about Coos Bay. We've benefited very much from Connect 1, 2, and 3. No doubt there'll be needs in the future, but we just want to speak in strong support of the Connect Oregon program because of what it can do for businesses in the state. So thank you very much, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome. Co-chairs Hunt and Bence, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Skip Tarr. I'm the owner and president of Tarr LLC in Portland. Tarr LLC is a third-generation Oregon company and is an example of an Oregon, small to mid-sized Oregon company whose growth strategy has been constrained by the tough economic times. The economic situation has made it difficult for small businesses to gain access to capital for development projects. Connect Oregon is a tremendous program for small companies with a desire to expand and improve their operations in regard to multimodal operations. Increasing the pool of available funds through House Bill 4020 and 4028 will benefit a multitude of small company projects who have applied to Connect Oregon 4. TAR LLC provides a variety of products to Oregon manufacturers in very specific forms that they require. Given the remoteness of Oregon to the major markets of the country, maximizing rail infrastructure is a key element to TAR and other small, mid-sized Oregon businesses. Let me give you a couple of examples of TAR. Semiconductor companies in Oregon, such as Intel, use large amounts of isopropyl alcohol. TAR purchases and receives from Gulf Area Refineries 30,000-gallon rail cars of isopropyl alcohol. Its Portland facility then processes and packages to exact customer specifications. Second example, TAR is the only Northwest federally licensed industrial distilled spirits plant, a DSP. As such, again, TAR purchases and receives full rail cars of industrial grade as well as food grade pure ethanol used in commercial applications and food processing. Again, TAR's Portland facility has the ability to customize the product and package it in smaller quantities to satisfy local manufacturers' requirements in cost-effective manners. These are but two examples of what TAR brings to the Oregon economy. Small companies adapt to the local needs better than their larger counterparts, and as a result, create stronger local economies. Prior to developing such capabilities at TAR, Oregon manufacturers were dependent on suppliers from California, Texas, and Midwest states. The TAR operation creates jobs by moving value-added services to Portland. It reduces cost to local manufacturers, thus helping them to compete more aggressively in global economies. It helps the environment through recycling of containers that would not occur outside the state, and reduces truck traffic on busy highways, thus providing positive safety and environmental impacts to the state's economic infrastructure. TAR is one example of a small company that participates in the state's economy through job creation in support of local manufacturers. TAR, like many other small businesses, desires to expand its operations. The current economic condition has had a negative effect on long-term lending and also makes small business owners take pause in contemplating long-term development projects. Connect Oregon funds can make the difference between doing the project and not doing the project, between bringing jobs to Oregon rather than another state. I urge you to support the passage of House Bill 4020 and House Bill 4028. Thank you for your consideration, and I'm available for any questions.
Thanks very much. Ralph.
Co-chairs, committee members, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm with CFM Strategic Communications. I'm representing Boise Cascade and the Coos Siskiyou Shippers Coalition. And if this seems sort of like deja vu, it was a month ago I sat before a committee that looked just like you folks, but they were interim. And hopefully I'm going to say the same thing, and I support what the O-Rule folks said. But our issue, and we have a Connect Oregon 4 grant that's waiting for funding, deals with tunnels on the Siskiyou rail line. And the reason why we need those tunnels repaired is because the mainline railroads are replacing all of their boxcars with taller, larger boxcars, and unless we get those tunnels fixed in the Siyous Law, we will not be able to ship forest products or other goods because there won't be available boxcars, and there won't be rail service for freight to in Southern Oregon, Medford area. So that's why we think this is very important, not just for the forest products industry, but for all business that ships by rail. Because unless we get those tunnels enlarged, there won't be boxcars to ship our goods. That's all I have.
Great. Questions for any of these three witnesses? We appreciate all three of you being here. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time.
Next up, Jim Guthrie, Jennifer Ryan, Jana Jarvis. Transportation Economic Development Committee. Proceed in whatever order you'd like. Jim, the point to you, I think.
Good morning, co-chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Guthrie. I'm with the Mount Hood Railroad. I'm the operations manager, and I've been with them over 24 years. We run a passenger and freight train out of Hood River, Oregon, and it starts at the Columbia and it goes up to the base of Mount Hood to a little community called Parkdale. And we run about 60,000 passengers a year, and we run over 500 freight cars, mainly lumber. And we're a very big part of the Hood River tourism. And in 2006, we had a major flood at milepost 15. In 2007, we got funding, and we were going to go out of business if we didn't get the funding. So Connect Oregon, we got the funding, and we got the train going again up to Parkdale. And that's the main reason I'm here, is to support the majors 4020 and 4028. That's all I have. Any questions?
Okay, great. We'll hear from all three and then ask for questions. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Ryan with Hatchmont McDowell, planning and engineering firm in Portland. We're located at 400 Southwest 6th Avenue, Suite 914, Portland 97204. I'm a transportation project manager with Hatchmont McDonald, and I specialize in rail transit, having worked in the civil engineering field for the last 23 years. OSU graduate and former TriMet employee, so I have a little expertise on a lot of different areas. And I'm also a board member on the Oregon Rail Users League. Hatchmont McDonald is an award-winning firm. We helped with the West Side Light Rail Tunnel. And we have over a century of construction management and design experience. And our goal is to help maintain Oregon's competitive edge by designing and managing the construction of improvements to the freeway, the rail, the transit, and the multimodal networks within the state. So I support increased funding for the Connect Oregon 4 through either House Bill 420 or 428 for the following reasons. One, it's going to fund highly skilled family wage jobs. It's going to maintain existing jobs. Underemployment is a huge issue, and I have several friends in the professional services, architecture, engineering field that are unemployed or underemployed. So it's a real issue up front in that community. And it funds jobs within the professional services and construction industries. So kind of a little more detail on that. On the funding high-skilled family wage jobs, the additional funds would go for construction for using Oregonians with unique skills in transit construction management for a lot of the transit center designs. Freight facilities construction, you've heard some of the reload facilities discussions in the warehouses, or for track inspection services such as the rehabilitation of the Mount Hood Railroad or the Coos Bay Rail Link. These are highly skilled family wage jobs, and many of them don't require necessarily a college degree, but they do have a lot of expertise that's unique within the nation. And maintains existing jobs. A lot of the railroads have very highly skilled positions within them, such as roadmaster, maintenance away engineer, building and bridges manager, the B&B, division engineer, chief engineer. Many of the railroad positions are rural. There's BNSF staff and Wishram the Dalles. We have UP staff in Pendleton. We heard from the Prineville folks, Ontario, Roseburg with Corp, Central Oregon, and Pacific Railroad. And there's a trickle-down effect of having these highly skilled, high-wage jobs in those small communities. The multimodal improvements that are proposed that would go along with this from Connect 4 would assist local companies in getting products to market, grain, auto parts, lumber, raw supplies to their facilities, such as the isopropyl alcohol, which, having worked at Tektronix, let me tell you, we loved our IPA. That's the isopropyl alcohol version of it. It also funds jobs within the professional services and construction industry, which people don't seem to, they always talk about these construction jobs and this vision of this laborer working away. Well, there's a resident engineer, there's an office engineer, there's office construction management staff, there's design staff that go along with this. About 10% of your construction projects go towards those professional services, design and construction management. And those are the, you know, highly skilled jobs that we're talking about, a good portion of which are within the railroads or the freight industry. The other portion of it, they contract out for firms like Hatchmont McDonald or T.Y. Lynn, who you've heard speak earlier. And those offices, major offices, are located in Portland and in Beaverton, Salem, Eugene, and in Bend. So they're all over the state now. And then the other piece of it is that those local funds, this would be considered local funds, could then leverage federal funds, you know, provide that 20% match for another 80% federal funds to come in to pay for part of the transit center construction or some of the track renewal. And then the private dollars also may be the last increment to tip over their rate of return or rate of investment, the ROI, for the railroads to do reinvestment in the local area rather than take their limited funds elsewhere. So in closing, I support the Connect Oregon 4 additional dollars for expanding our transportation network to maintain our existing skilled workforce and add new jobs. And please consider my strong support for those two bills. Thank you for your time, and I'll look forward to questions.
Great. Thank you. Janet, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, the members of the committee. I'm Janet Jarvis here on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I was before you almost a year ago in March discussing this very same issue. I don't have much new to add to my arguments then, but I do think agriculture comes to you from a little different perspective. When you think about wheat, most of you will think about Umatilla County and putting wheat on barges and bringing it down the river to the Port of Portland and to market. But wheat is actually grown in 22 out of Oregon's 36 counties. So there are a number of regions in this state where getting product to market at affordably is a significant issue. And if you think about these kinds of products, growers don't have the ability to negotiate freight costs, and because they're commodity pricing on their product, they don't have the opportunity to build the transportation costs into their product. And so at the end of the day, in order to keep these farmers viable, we need to have the least expensive, most efficient forms of transportation available to them in a variety of forms, depending on different regions of the state. And so for that reason, we would lend our support to you considering an increase in the funding in through House Bill 4020 or 4028. So with that, thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for any of these three witnesses? Thank you all very much. Appreciate you being here. Okay, I think we will next go to Mark Landauer, who I think is wearing two different hats. Was Chris Fick planning to testify? Okay, great. Go ahead, there you go. Ann, come forward. And Jody Christensen.
Good morning. Chairs Hunt and Benz, members of the committee. My name is Jody Christensen. I'm the Executive Director of the McMinnville Economic Development Partnership. I'm here today as a representative of the Oregon Economic Development Association, often referred to as OEDA. OEDA has over 70 members representing economic development organizations, cities, counties, and chambers in the state of Oregon. We are your boots on the ground in your communities, working with businesses to make sure they come to Oregon, stay in Oregon, and grow in Oregon. Often the work of economic development is not glamorous. Job creation and retention time and again requires your communities to act and react quickly to ensure that basic infrastructure is in place to facilitate business expansions and relocations. In these instances, your communities frequently turn to the Special Public Works Fund at the Oregon Business Development Department. These funds provide loans and grants for publicly owned facilities that support economic and community development in Oregon. Many Economic Development Association members are eligible for use of these Special Public Work Funds resources. HB 4028 will recapitalize this fund with $10 million in lottery bond proceeds. Eligible projects often exceed available resources in these funds. OEDA and its members believe recapitalization of the Special Public Works Fund is essential into 2012. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm also testifying on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities and the Oregon Economic Development Association. You have my written testimony before you. A couple things I want to emphasize is that this is very good timing for passage of this bill, because as the economy is starting to improve right now, what we're seeing are a lot of requests coming in for business expansions and locations. And the infrastructure, which is often provided through the Special Public Works Fund and the Connect Oregon, are absolutely essential for economic development. Oftentimes, projects are very complex, and it requires several different sources in order to make a water and sewer project happen, for example. And it may require the Special Public Works Fund. It also may require community development block grant and safe drinking water and EDA. We are seeing, as you can see in the testimony, that appropriation for CDBG and safe drinking water have been going down, which makes the Special Public Works Fund all the more essential. And the last thing I want to add is that we're over the years, many of the systems have become antiquated. We've had communities that expanded that need to be able to reach further with water and sewer projects, and also some communities that are way out of date in terms of their systems and need to be improved. So thank you very much. We very much support both Special Public Works Fund as well as Connect Oregon, which funds multimodal projects. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Hunt and Benz, members of the committee. I'm Mark Landauer. I represent the Oregon Public Ports Association, as well as the Special Districts Association of Oregon. The members I represent, both ports, water, municipal water suppliers, and sanitary sewer providers, support both bills that are before you today. As mentioned previously, the needs for infrastructure in the state of Oregon far outpaces or outstrips the available funding. Many of those projects are very critical to the economic viability of many businesses within our territories. These programs often provide, as mentioned previously, either the leverage or gap financing that will allow these projects to turn dirt. Many of the sanitary sewer systems, water supply systems, are either not in compliance with state or federal standards. Some don't simply have the capacity to serve new and or expanding businesses. And these funds will allow those communities either to retain or attract new jobs. Much of the support has been mentioned today, why we are here today, but I do want to mention one thing. The ports have recently gone through several projects that we believe are ready to turn dirt within the next 6 months. We have identified several projects that will either retain or expand job opportunities in the state of Oregon. The permits are in hand. The problem is the money isn't there. And through these financing programs, we could turn dirt, create jobs, retain jobs in various communities throughout this state, but for the funding. And that's the message that we'd like to make sure you're clear about. There are jobs that are dependent on these projects, and we can turn dirt within those 6 months, but for the funding. Thank you very much. We hope that you'll move both of these bills forward, and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions for these three folks? Can I just ask one question? The Infrastructure Finance Authority has made some specific changes trying to make the loans more accessible, especially for maybe lower-income, smaller communities. As you look at the possibility, because obviously we have limited lottery bonding resources here, do you have any doubt or concern that there might be an inadequate demand within the Special Public Works Fund for this $10 million?
I would say no. I think over the last couple of years, there was some hesitation by communities to tap into it until they saw that the economy was starting to improve. I think they're starting to see a lot more demand right now in building, and so there's pent up demand, I would say, for this that's going to be required if we're going to meet the needs of businesses that are coming in.
I'll share with you that over the last 30 days in McMinnville, we've had a substantial increase in inquiries about our community. And I think that's not unusual in Oregon. There is something happening where companies are, while they're cautious, they're seeing the opportunity. And it's unfortunate when communities can't compete for some of these very viable projects because they can't supply water. Or they can't supply basic. And not to speak out of turn, but your job is to help our communities become competitive. Our job as economic development agencies and organizations is to help get those jobs on the ground. Your job is to help us get the ground ready. And these kinds of funds that you're making available are going to, it's the quiet work behind the scenes. These aren't going to be the headlines that you're going to see in the newspaper, but eventually it's part of a bigger puzzle that we put together to make these projects happen. These funds are essential to our small communities, particularly, I see it in Yamhill County. They can't even come or knock on the door on some of these projects because they don't have clean water. They don't have an infrastructure that even lets them in the room. So these funds are essential for those communities.
Great. Good. Appreciate you all being here. Thank you. I actually did skip over a few folks on, I think there are three remaining folks who wanted to speak to the transportation component of the bill. Jerry Bohard, Doug Barber, Tom Schwetz.
Good morning, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohard. I'm the interim deputy director of operations for the Oregon Department of Transportation. You've been hearing some wonderful stories about Connect Oregon this morning, and so I'm going to step back a little bit and just talk a little bit about where we are and what the numbers are showing. First of all, in the packet that provided in the testimony, there is a map, and it identifies the five regions within the Connect Oregon program. And also what we've tried to do is identify the number of applications each of the regions have received and their value, and then off to the side, it's often also broken down by mode. So just some information there. So just as a reminder, so in 2005, 2007, and 2009, the legislature allocated $300 million of state lottery funds towards what we call the Connect Oregon program. And then in the last session, identified additional $40 million. Since that, the first three cycles, we've funded 166 projects and leveraged $413 million in private and federal investments. And as of last month, 97 projects are complete and 69 projects are in the design and construction phase. I think, as you're well aware, the passage of these bills would increase the amount of lottery funds for a total of $50 million. Within the Connect Oregon program, 10% goes to each of the five regions, so this would also increase the amount, a minimum amount going to each of the regions. We are in the process right now of going through the applications. Initially, we received 70 applications for approximate value of $86 million. We do review those applications for completeness and for feasibility and do an economic analysis. We're at the point in time where we anticipate that we'll have 65 applications, which is what your map represents, with a request of approximately $78 million. So in the next couple of weeks, I think you've heard our five modal committees will start their review. The five regional committees will then do their review in April. And we have a final review committee do their work in June. With the commission gaveling down on the project list, it's anticipated to be in August. I will tell you that this model is similar to the model that we've followed in Connect 1, 2, and 3. We've received a lot of very positive accolades about this process, where we have other states actually looking at both the process and the way the revenues are put forward. Also, in my testimony, I won't go into it. We do identify the criteria. That is part of the legislation. And so I'll just close by saying the Multimodal Transportation Fund finances grants and loans for non-highway transportation projects across the state through the Connect Oregon program. House Bill 4020 and 4028 would increase the amount of lottery-backed revenues from $40 million to $50 million in the current biennium to fund the Connect Oregon 4 projects. Connect Oregon has proven to be a successful program, resulting in investments to date of $712 million in state, federal, and private funds to improve Oregon's transportation system, supporting the economy to the benefit of Oregon businesses and citizens. Should House Bill 4020 or 4028 become law, the department will recommend that the Oregon Transportation Commission award the additional funds to the Connect Oregon 4 projects through the applications received as of November 2011. Thank you.
Can I just ask, it seems a little discriminatory that Co-Chair Bentz gets his own region of ODOT on this map. Can you speak to that? No.
Sure, it should be, of course.
Welcome.
Chairs, committee members, good morning. My name is Tom Schwetz. I'm the Planning and Development Director for Lane Transit District, and I appreciate the opportunity this morning to come to you and talk a little bit about our bus rapid transit system, the Emerald Express, or MX. In case you're not familiar with the concept of bus rapid transit, it's a strategy that's becoming increasingly used across the country to address a couple of key community goals. The increase of the effectiveness and efficiency of transit and the leveraging of that improvement in transit in the growth and development of communities across the country. To that end, the strategy involves the use of rubber-tired vehicles running in portions along the corridor in its own right-of-way, using frequencies that allow users to not have to rely on schedules, about 10-minute frequencies. In a period where public agencies are struggling for ways in which they can both reduce their costs and increase service, bus rapid transit represents one of those kinds of strategies. Let me give you an example of that. In our region, we provide about $36 million in service to the community every year. Much of that service runs on congested corridors. That does two things, transit operating and congestion. One is it's a much less attractive service. A number of people I've heard talk about, well, I could be sitting in my car for all this. In a similar vein, about 80% of our costs are in the drivers that we have driving those buses around. So when they're sitting in congestion, it's not a very efficient condition. And so it's with that in mind that we turn to the development of bus rapid transit in our community. We opened the first corridor running between downtown Eugene and downtown Springfield in 2007. In the first year of that service, we were able to double the transit ridership in that corridor. We were also able to reduce the cost per passenger by 35% and reduce the transit travel time in that corridor by about 30%. So now we move to the third corridor that we have, looking at West Eugene MX Extension. It's a 4.2-mile extension running from downtown Eugene out to just east of Beltline, if you where Beltline intersects 11th, if you're familiar with that. That project, assuming things remain on track, would probably open in 2017. And we expect that it would create a one-seat ride from that part of the region all the way up into the River Bend Gateway Mall area in Springfield. The connection would link 52,000 residents to 64,000 jobs within the market area of the MX system. It would increase ridership by about 500,000 riders per year. It would also achieve similar reductions in transit travel times for that part of the corridor. The construction would create about 1,200 jobs. So as we look again forward at where we're moving with the transit in our community, we think it's vitally important to continue to invest in the bus rapid transit system to essentially protect the much more significant investment we make in the service. So thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thanks. Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, Doug Barber here also representing Lane Transit District today. The bus rapid transit system that Tom just talked about has a long connection with Connect Oregon. For those of you who were here in the 2005 session, Lane Transit's BRT system, as it was called then, was one of the primary examples that was used to help sell Connect Oregon One. It was kind of one of the transit poster childs for the kind of project that Connect Oregon was designed to fund and enhance. Lane Transit did get funding to help with the second leg of the MX system through Connect Oregon. Now, as Tom mentioned, we're on to the third leg, and what brings us here today is actually an amendment that we're working with Representative Hunt on for House Bill 4028. The funding for this project is a little different. It is we started in the 2009 session with a $30 million lottery bond request. Ways and Means at that time said, do you really need all that money all at once? We said no. It's phased over a number of bienniums. So in 2009, Ways and Means appropriated $1.6 million for the project. In the 2011 session, our request was for $8.4 million. $4.2 million of that was appropriated last spring, and Ways and Means said, you can come back in February and request the other half of that money, the other $4.2 million. In the interim, we have been both talking with leadership about how tight funding is, both in general and in the bond funds, and taking a closer look at our project, about exactly what funding we need to get us to the 2013 biennium. And so we reduced our funding request from $4.2 million to $1.2 million. And we have been working with the Capital Construction Subcommittee on a lottery bond request for that. But in doing so, they said, well, We can do that. We can work through Capital Construction Subcommittee, but Representative Hunt also has this Connect Oregon bill that seems to fit with your project. Maybe there's a way to work there as well. So we've been in talking with Representative Hunt on an amendment that would be able to put our $1.2 million request into 4028. The reason we need an amendment is twofold. We did not apply for Connect Oregon 4 funds for this project for two reasons. It was really our request was too large initially, and I think technically our project does not fit the criteria for Connect Oregon 4 at this time because it would not qualify or be defined as a shovel-ready project at this point. Our project is still in the engineering and design phase. We expect to know the federal funds for the project. We expect to be have announced at the end of February, early March this year. We are hoping to hear that this project will receive $75 million in federal funds, which is what the state funds will help us leverage. We will need to come back to the 2013 session with another request, which would be the bulk of those funds, to put that whole package together to leverage the $75 million in federal funds. But the $1.2 million that we are requesting in this amendment is what would bridge that gap between the $4.2 million that we've already received from the state and the money that we hope to get in the 2013 session. So I've met with Legislative Council yesterday. They were working on the amendment. I've not seen the amendment yet. It may be done, but I'm not certain. And I'm happy to answer any questions about that. I understand it's complete.
Great. Thank you. Questions for any of these three? Okay. Appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much. I believe we've completed everyone who wanted to talk about the transportation components. I think we just have two more folks who want to speak to the Special Public Works Fund and then several who want to speak to the community college piece. So let's bring up John McArdle and Lynn Schlosser to, I think as I'm looking at the list, they're the only remaining two on the Special Public Works.
Mr. Chair.
John.
I'm going to be doing the community colleges. I'm wearing the day job.
Yeah, thank you. Good correction, John. Okay, Lynn, you're the cleanup speaker on Special Public Works. Who more appropriate?
Thank you, Chair Hunt. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Schlosser. I'm the director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. We certainly welcome the additional funds that House Bill 4028 provides to the Special Public Works Program. And let me just confirm, frankly, the comments that you've already heard. In the past 6 months, we have had increasing inquiries from communities that do want to fund water and wastewater projects. As was indicated to you during the course of the worst of these economic times of recent years, our demand and the inquiries we received had diminished substantially, but in the last 6 months, they have increased greatly. At present, our pace of loan commitments right now for this first quarter of the biennium indicates, if it continues, that we will double the number of loans that we provided last biennium. So you can see the demand has increased greatly. As I mentioned to you when we talked about a month ago, I have an ongoing list of communities that I pack around with me that have inquiries into us. That list totals up to $300 million worth of project, but I, quick to acknowledge that, not all of those are going to happen immediately, but it is a substantial list that we work from constantly, and it provides the pace of applications that we're going to likely see. So with that, thank you, and if there's any questions, I'd be glad to respond.
Coach Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if you answered this 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, but what is the reason for the delay in moving forward on the $300 million you just mentioned? Maybe there's a list of the reasons.
Chair and members of the committee, Representative Bence, it's simply a matter of we work with these communities to make sure they are ready and positioned to follow through when we make a commitment to them. And so there's a lot of engineering work preliminary that needs to go into these projects, making sure that the city councils are fully aware of thoughts of the city administrator or manager, and they are on board for the probable rate increases that are going to be needed in order to support this additional debt. It's just getting everything lined up so that we have a clean package that comes into us for our approval so we can then move quickly.
I love this, Chair. So I'm trying to ask, is it the city's problem or is it our problem? Which side is occasioning the delay? Is it we're waiting for them or are they waiting for us?
Members of the committee, Representative Bentz, interestingly enough, we have a board that we have with our current projects and we post, it's through our lien activities, but we post, is the delay due to the city? Is the delay due to us? Most of the time, we are seeing that the communities, because they're the small communities that have part-time city councils, oftentimes part-time city managers or city recorders, it takes them time to make their decisions and move forward. But I think it's very clear from our activities on identifying the needs of those communities that we are going to have to work more closely and pay more attention to those communities to help them move faster.
Thank you.
Lynn, I think it's only been maybe 3 months or so since you and the board made the decision to drop the interest rate down to that more accessible 1% level in certain cases. Do you have enough experience to sense, have you hit the sweet spot there in terms of giving access to those communities who might not have been able to go forward otherwise, or do you have enough experience yet in that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've only worked sincerely with one community that would be eligible by virtue of their city's average annual income, and certainly that difference is making a substantial change in what's affordable to them versus what they would have to pay without that benefit.
Do you see potentially further expanding out the pool that would be eligible for that 1% to a broader definition of communities across the state? Is that an ongoing conversation?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we haven't considered that yet because I think you've identified we don't have enough experience to know whether benefiting those communities who have a below average annual income for the state are going to tap the resources to the degree we can afford to make that concession. So we're cautious and implementing it slowly, but certainly to the degree we find that through the course of time our portfolio performs, interest rates are favorable, that we can do that. On a broader scope, absolutely, we'll consider that in the future.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So we'll now invite up John Wyckoff and the two representatives from Oregon's best community college, Joanne Truesdell and Lowell Miles. Now, you know, I didn't want to be partisan saying that, so I did check just for independent verification with Representative Sheehan, and he reconfirmed that CCC is Oregon's best community college. So, actually, you have two counties. I forgot. I don't want to get you in trouble. I forget you have two counties.
CCC is fine.
Welcome.
Chair Hunt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, representing 17 of Oregon's best community colleges. Today we want to talk to you about several of the projects that we've put forward for this piece of legislation. And since the beginning of the recession, we've talked a lot about community colleges being economic first responders in a bad economy. And the package that we put together really reflects that. And you can really see that role that the community colleges have played and what has happened with our enrollment since the beginning of the recession. We're up over 30% since the beginning of the recession. As many of you know, our funding has dropped precipitously over that time. As state funding for many programs has, which puts a lot of strain on the colleges to be able to offer programs, especially in areas like career technical programs that are higher cost programs for both the maintaining of equipment and for offering those programs. So the package that we have put together focuses on those career technical programs as well as STEM programs, because these are the programs that in many ways are most directly related to jobs that meet local workforce needs and in areas where students are most likely to get good family wage jobs. And so that really is sort of the theme of the package that we have put together. This package includes all 17 colleges. There is a project for each of the colleges, and they're in areas like manufacturing, allied health, animal science, welding, automotive technology, and the like. We've included with our packet labor market information, so you can see that there's a direct need in each community for each of these projects. And so I want to just talk very quickly, just sort of reference a couple of the projects, and then you'll hear from folks from the colleges who can talk a bit more about their particular projects. But just draw your attention to a few. For example, extension of a veterinary assistance program at Blue Mountain Community College, expansion of the welding certificate program at Clatsop, and the automotive technology and diesel tech programs at Lynn Benton. And that one allows them to update that program to be able to deal with new vehicles such as hybrids and electric cars. And so these are the types of programs we put together, and again, they're all based on, and we have that information for you, on local labor market needs. And so with that, I would turn it over to the folks that we have here who can talk a bit more about the specific projects.
Great.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm president of Clackamas Community College, and I'm privileged to be here today with a 25-year veteran supporter of Clackamas Community College, Mr. Lowell Miles of Miles Composite. And his involvement with us, and I'd like to have him take a moment to speak first, is not only as our foundation chair for many years, several rotations, a longtime foundation member of the College Foundation, a business supporter in terms of partner, not only our students being able to have access to quality internships at his site, but also just good partnerships in ensuring economic growth for his industry. And lastly, but not least, certainly a friend of the community when it comes to supporting everyone in our business community, regardless of what business they're in, and economic development for all of our citizens. I'd like to have Lowell talk a little bit first about how he sees our project in manufacturing. Industrial technology is our primary focus, and also in health sciences.
Welcome, and please state your name for the record, Lowell.
Thank you, Representative Hunt, co-chair, and Representative Benz, co-chair. Thanks for inviting me here. I'd like to, for the record, say my name is Lowell Miles, and I own Miles Fiberglass and Composites. We have a plant in Oregon City and one on the 205 freeway near the town center. We have close to 100 employees at the present time, and we have it's a family business. We have family members working in the business. I have two daughters and two son-in-laws, and I also have seven grandkids and nine great-grandkids, so I'm fairly certain we'll have some future employees that we're growing right now. I started the business over 50 years ago, and we've had ups and downs, all like all businesses do. We've had recessions before that we've worked through, and we've been going through one here recently, and it's been tough, but we've hung in there like we have before. Things are getting better. I think they're going to continue to get better, and but we also have an aging workforce, which means that we have to replace those people. I have people who, none of them are old as I am, but we have some that's been with us 10, 15, and 20 years. So some of those will be retiring in the near future, as well as the whole workforce, particularly in manufacturing in this area. And we also need to continue to train people so that they can fill those jobs, not only the ones that are being retired, but the expanding businesses and workforce that we're going to need here. One emphasis on that, I've also on the WICO, Clackamas County WICO Committee, have been for a number of years. The last meeting we had, there was three employers that spoke out saying that they were looking for trained employees and couldn't find any. Even though we have high employment, there is still a very large need for trained employees, in especially in certain aspects and certain jobs out there. And they were having a difficult job finding trained employees. We've worked with the Clackamas Community College in our business in training, various training cooperative jobs, and one in training people to repair windmill blades. That's one of our businesses that we do. We sent out as many as 80 people at one time repairing windmills all over the United States, and also making some windmill parts and for their aftermarket. But the training and the cooperation we've had with Clackamas Community College has been great. We wouldn't have been able to have those programs and the training programs that we've been able to do without the community college involvement and the help that they've given us. There's a need for this money for infrastructure and new equipment and so forth. Just one example, the community college just received three very expensive pieces of equipment free from a company that was able to loan us the equipment. We'll use the equipment, and then when they have a sale for it, they'll sell it and replace it with more up-to-date equipment. This is very expensive, high-tech equipment that the college wouldn't have been able to have without that. And so when I say we got it free, that's not quite the whole story. It cost $66,000 to put in new electrical and remodel for the installation of that equipment. And that's typical even in our business. We bought a vacuum forming machine that we budgeted $150,000 for. By the time we got it installed and new electrical wiring and everything, we put another $50,000 into it. So it's that type of thing that kind of unforeseen, but even though we got the equipment loaned to us and we took advantage of that, the money, the $66,000, had to come from someplace else, which cut into instruction and that type of thing. I've been on the Clackamas Community College Foundation Board, like Joanne mentioned, for about 25 years now. And one of the reasons that I've stuck in there and participated is because it's a great group of people, for one thing. All of them have the community and the progress of our community at heart. But the college is a great place to be associated with. Just the management, the way it's run, the teachers' involvement. I think we're one of the few colleges that the faculty participates in a fundraiser every year for the foundation. It's just been a great experience for me. But the main reason is the stories that come out of the students continually, all the time, about what the college has done for them, the training has done for them. You know, you hear stories that they didn't even think they could go to college, and then they had the opportunity, and all of a sudden they kind of go from despair, wondering what they're going to do, to training that they looking forward to, and a future that they really have some enthusiasm about, and just a whole new outlook in life. That's that's the main reason that I've been involved and will continue to.
Thank you. So, Mr. Miles represents a number of organizations and businesses in our district, and at the highest level, a couple of things about leveraging and economic development. This year, Clackamas Community College, in concert with 17 community colleges, managed to receive a very highly selected credential acceleration support for employer grant called the CASE grant. It's $18 million in the next 3 years to focus on the kinds of career technical education programs that this kind of infrastructure helps ensure that we not only have the right facility, the right kind of facility, and the right kinds of equipment to actually increase the wage opportunities for individuals. In our district, we are targeting advanced industrial technology and health sciences, and for the primary reason that entry-level wages in our district would be $19 or greater. So we specifically set out to do that. The second piece is, why is this important to Clackamas Community College and our local businesses? In every downturn in the economy, regardless of how long it is, all of our career technical education providers, businesses who are doing that, health sciences, through manufacturing, through automotive, have retooled. And they retool for productivity and efficiency, and their expectation is when students, regardless of whether or not they are brand new students, 22 years old, or they are returning because they were laid off elsewhere, or they are incumbent workers needing to get an upgrade, all of those companies have reinvested in technology that is much more advanced than what we currently have. And as community colleges, if we're to be part and continue to be part of keeping our companies very competitive from the get-go, that's what we need. Companies are talking about, as Mr. Miles said, about the fact that there's a mismatch in skills. It is not necessarily a mismatch in general skill levels. It's a mismatch in where they're headed next with the kinds of technology, and that companies cannot afford 6 months' worth of training on their new equipment in order to remain competitive. And as a company within our county, as a company within our state, as a company within our nation. So for us, the reason, again, that this is highly important is that it allows our students to have more time on task with equipment that gets them into the companies and gets them productive and also at a higher wage. If you think about our investment request of the $10 million is $800,000. The average employee at entry level that graduates from the programs we are targeting is $40,000. It takes 20 employees this next year, employed 1 year, to repay back an $800,000 mark. If we just pretend that we're looking at 11% in tax rate for a $40,000, which is not true, but let's just pretend, it's not long before this gets paid back into our economy. And what we do know is this can kick the type of employment that we need that will support the general fund in this state that helps reinvest into many of the other programs in which health, safety, and education is certainly at a disadvantage at this time. So thank you very much.
Questions for these three witnesses? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to thank you for coming and testifying today and building such a wonderful business and employing 60 people, taking risk and investing money. And I think we need to always applaud entrepreneurs for taking risk and employing Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I've lived the American dream.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate you all being here. Next up, John McArdle, Cheryl Roberts, Gerald Hamilton.
Thank
Please
you.
Proceed.
Yeah.
Co-chairs Hunt and Benz, thank you very much for allowing us to come today. For the record, my name is Gerald Hamilton, president of Klamath Community College. You've seen a great list of 17 great projects. I'd speak directly to one in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And those of you who know Klamath Falls, Oregon, it's a very different conversation than what you may have just heard. And so our proposal is a little different, but it isn't any less important to our community. Specifically, our proposal includes plans to remodel and enlarge an existing building to include a culinary laboratory. Oftentimes in our community, we go out and where are their jobs? And where can we train or retrain folks for the jobs that exist in our community? That's what we have done in this case. This laboratory will allow us to train an annual cohort of 15 students. So at one time, we would have in associate degree programs up to 30 students in this program, in the associate degree program. But as well as that, we see 25 students in associated short-term career pathways. And what's really exciting about this is that we would be able to use it to support our businesses and in most cases small businesses, oftentimes home businesses, to provide the training that they need to become larger or increase their ability to employ folks. So we estimate at the minimum we would be able to train or retrain 80 students a year in this facility. I don't think it's any surprise to say that the unemployment in Klamath Falls is high. We just lost another major employer earlier this week that's closing down and will cost 50 jobs in our community. But there are openings in the food service industry. State data suggests that about 18% of the high demand occupations in Klamath Falls are going to be in the food service industry. And as we spoke to our local restaurant owners and folks that as we were doing our research, they were excited about these employees and our graduates. We believe that this is our next great step in our service to our community, being able to retrain them for jobs that do exist. So with that, I would just close by saying, you know, our part of this is only $300,000, but small investments in small communities make great differences. And for us to be able to do this and invite our community in to be retrained and to look at a brighter future is very important. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure. Okay, very quick question, sir.
Yes, sir.
Who's closing in Klamath Falls?
It's called Mako. It used to be called Aqua Glass, and they make tub and shower enclosures in homes. Of course, it's tied to the building business. Mm-hmm. You may have noticed that it was in the Oregonian and other papers early this week. So those are huge blows to small communities, small rural communities.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you bet.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Cheryl Roberts for the record, and I'm the president of Chemeketa Community College. Many of you may know that we started off as Salem Technical High School, and so we have a really rich history of providing technical education for our valley. And I'm here to talk about our specific project, but I would like to say that this is very emblematic of all the community colleges, the importance of creating the infrastructure so that we can meet the bold goals of 40-40-20. And we know we have the right people to do the work, and I have to say that Joanne cut her teeth in leadership at Chemeketa. We also have the right priorities. Now we're looking at the right places or infrastructure to be able to do that and to serve our communities. So we have actually two phases to our request in support of 40-28. The first has to do with advanced manufacturing and machining. We are looking at renovating and modernizing and creating strategic equipment investments. So we would like to expand our laboratory to 6 stations. We're looking at new CNC equipment. That will allow us to ensure that the students that are graduating are going to be high-performing and make a difference, those machinists going out into the industry. The second phase or distinctive piece of our request has to do with 3 other programs. One is in visual communications around web and graphic design. The other is drafting and civil engineering technology, and then our engineering transfer program. It's renovating and expanding over 18,000 square feet to ensure that we have the right, again, infrastructure to support the kind of learning that our students need to be successful. At Chemeketa, we don't just have a mission statement. We make commitments and promises to our community. And we are trying to ensure not only just economic vitality, but that what we're doing in terms of workforce development, technical education, and business support help to support not just our students, because when they are successful, our communities succeed. So we hope that you will continue to think about supporting 4028 for community colleges. Thank you.
And I would just note that Dr. Truesdell, before she cut her teeth in leadership at Chemeketa, was a student at Clackamas Community College.
That's right. That's right. And actually, I have to be very helpful because she was actually applying for the job when I was, so I was really grateful that she went to Clackamas. I wouldn't be here today.
Good morning, chairs and members of the committee. I'm appearing before you as the Director of Development, Lynn Benton Community College, and I'm here to speak very briefly about our advanced transportation technology project that's in your packet. LVCC has had a successful auto diesel program for nearly 40 years, but things are changing in America. Let me tell you the story. A number of years ago, we were meeting with one of our national partners, Snap-on Tools, the largest manufacturer of tools in the United States. They started talking about propulsion systems. And after about the third time of saying propulsion systems, I said, "Say what?" They talked about nobody's really investing in the internal combustion engine anymore. They're continuing to use that, but looking at electric, hybrid, compressed natural gas, fuel cells, who's going to fix those kind of vehicles and that transportation system? Where are those kind of technicians coming? One of the things that community colleges are in charge of doing is not just providing the training for a workforce to meet today's needs, but to meet the needs that are coming in the next couple of years, and it really is coming. So this particular project will provide training and retraining for students so that they can go out and meet the needs that our industry folks are talking about that need to be happening. Who's going to fix the car, the Prius car that you have, the compressed natural gas vehicle, and let it be known, what happens when one kind of car with a hybrid crunches into a natural gas car, mm-hmm. and you got leaking gas, you see what I mean? And where do you cut people out? So those are the kind of things that we need to help train people to do. And it's a good project, it's good for Oregon. Thank you.
Great. Any questions for these three? Appreciate y'all being here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I think we got through everyone who has signed up. Did anyone else want to testify who we've not called up yet on these bills? Okay, great. So as I think you heard, colleagues, there are two amendments that are in the process of being drafted. One is basically the OCCA proposal, because in the draft bill it just refers to $10 million for community colleges specifically for workforce, but doesn't spell out anything beyond that. So the community colleges, to their credit, have gone out and all 17 schools have put together this proposal, which actually gets far greater reach across the state than I would have ever guessed they could with $10 million, while still sticking with that workforce development focus and also trying to maximize the additional matching funds that would be leveraged across the state. So that will be one amendment that will be coming, and then the other one will be an amendment for your consideration specifically around the EMX proposal that was spoken to by a couple panels ago. Other Representative Nathans?
Mr. Chair, a couple years ago we had a project where I think it might have been Department of Administrative Services kept track of the Go Oregon money so that we could see how many jobs were being created, how many people from Oregon were employed as opposed to bringing in specialists from out of state, for example. Would these jobs be subject to the same kind of record keeping so that we could see how the money was how it was playing out as being useful for Oregon's economy?
You know, that may be a very good possible third amendment to add in that specific kind of focus, because that was actually required in the legislation then. And so I would bet it would probably be done anyway, but one way to guarantee it would be to actually put it in the bill. Good suggestion. Yeah, and I think based on the experience, I mean, I think the community colleges probably were the leading model within that package, because they really did a good job of breaking down the projects into bite-sized chunks, which dramatically increased the likelihood that they were going to get bid on by Oregon businesses, as opposed to, you know, bidding out big, humongous projects that were more at risk of going to an out-of-state firm. Any other comments or discussion? All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bills 4020 and 4028. We meet next on Monday morning, bright and early, at 8 a.m.
Yeah, so we're doing. I